Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, online fitness coach, nutritionist, and three-time best-selling author, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests in all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is with Cyrus Cambatta, PhD, and Robbie Barbero, the authors of Mastering Diabetes, the revolutionary method to reverse insulin resistance permanently in type 1, type 2, and pre-diabetes. This is an episode that I haven't previously explored in terms of topic on the podcast and might not necessarily be one for you, but if it is an episode that you need, it's a must listen. If you fall anywhere on the diabetes spectrum, either type 1, type 1.5, type 2, pre-diabetes, or even gestational diabetes, today's podcast is for you, or any family member or friends that you have who suffer with a chronic illness. In today's podcast, we talk about the different types of diabetes and pre-diabetes, how the conventional wisdom of low-carb, high-fat diet is misguided, why food is medicine and what they recommend when it comes to reversing insulin resistance, how their personal experience with diabetes inspired their lifestyle choices, and the green, yellow, and red food choice list for reversing insulin resistance. We do go a little bit heavy into the science in parts of today's episode. But if you are somebody, as I mentioned, who suffers or struggles or is on that diabetic spectrum from anywhere from type 1 all the way up to type 2 and even into gestational diabetes, this is a must listen. It's packed full of information, education to arm yourself with the tools to make the changes to improve your quality of life. So I hope you get an extreme amount of value from today's episode. So without further ado, here is Cyrus Cambatta, PhD, and Robbie Barbero on Mastering Diabetes, the revolutionary method to reverse insulin resistance permanently in type 1, type 2, and pre-diabetes. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guests, Cyrus Cambatta and Robbie Barbero. Cyrus and Robbie are the co-authors of the New York Times best-selling book, Mastering Diabetes, the revolutionary method to reverse insulin resistance permanently in type 1, type 1.5, type 2, pre-diabetes, and gestational diabetes. They are also the team behind MasteringDiabetes.org, an online coaching platform for people living with all forms of diabetes that focus on low-fat, plant-based, whole food nutrition. Cyrus has a PhD in nutritional biochemistry from UC Berkeley and has been living with type 1 diabetes since 2002. Robbie has a master's degree in public health and has been living with type 1 diabetes since 2000. Current medical wisdom advises that anyone suffering from diabetes or pre-diabetes should eat a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet, but in this paradigm shifting book, they go through a century of research to reveal how that advice is misguided. So I'm looking forward to talking all things diabetes in today's show. Cyrus, Robbie, welcome to the podcast.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having us here, Brian. We appreciate it.
Yeah, really excited to be talking to you today.
Me too. This is a topic that I haven't previously covered in depth on the podcast, and I'm really excited to go into it. But before we do it, just as a jumping off point for any listeners who are unfamiliar, can you talk about the different types of diabetes and maybe pre-diabetes in there as well, just so that people have that kind of educational layering that we can go into different directions with today's podcast?
For sure. So historically, people have thought of diabetes as basically having like two flavors. Flavor number one was called type 1 diabetes, and flavor number two is called type 2 diabetes. But it turns out that over the course of time, there's actually been a whole collection of different types of diabetes that have sort of complicated the picture to a certain extent. In today's world, there's I think six different types of diabetes. There's type 1, type 1.5, pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes, gestational diabetes, and what's considered type 3 diabetes, which is actually Alzheimer's disease. So the whole landscape has gotten a little bit more complicated, but to keep things relatively simple and straightforward, a simple way to think about it is there's two buckets. Bucket number one is autoimmune. Bucket number two is non-autoimmune. It's just that simple, okay? So the autoimmune varieties of diabetes include type 1 and 1.5. And type 1 diabetes is canonically thought of as a type of diabetes that happens when you are young, when you're a kid. You get it when you're either 2 years old or 5 years old or 14 years old, sometime in your adolescence. And it is a result of an autoimmune attack to the insulin producing beta cells in your pancreas. Okay. So what causes that autoimmune attack? Well, the research community doesn't fully have an answer to that yet, but they've discovered over the course of time that there are certain components of the food system which can create a process called molecular mimicry, and that can then lead to an autoimmune reaction, which can then destroy the insulin-producing beta cells in your pancreas. There's certain types of viruses that you can contract, and those viruses can then set the stage for an autoimmune reaction as well. The net result is that the insulin producing beta cells in your pancreas get attacked, and then as a result of that, they can't produce as much insulin as they had historically. And eventually, this autoimmune condition will result in you producing zero or very close to zero insulin. Okay, so that's type 1 diabetes. Type 1.5 diabetes is effectively the same thing, except there's two slight differences. Number one, it happens in people who are older than the age of 30. And number two, it is a slower progressing version of type 1 diabetes. So rather than losing your insulin producing ability and having it go down to zero within the course of, call it 12 months or 18 months, which is common in type 1 diabetes, type 1.5 diabetes usually takes 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. In some people, they may just end up reducing their insulin production capacity, but never going to zero. So you can think of it, the way that I think about it is that type 1.5, also called LADA, latent autoimmune diabetes in adults, LADA, is a adult onset, slow progressing version of type 1 diabetes. Okay. Now, there's a lot of details there, and without being complicated, both of those are autoimmune versions of diabetes, okay? The non-autoimmune bucket contains prediabetes, type 2 diabetes, gestational diabetes, and then Alzheimer's disease or type 3 diabetes, okay? So prediabetes is a condition that's caused by insulin resistance. And we're gonna get deep into insulin resistance today so we can really understand what causes it. So suffice it to say for the time being, insulin resistance is the precursor to prediabetes. Prediabetes is the precursor to type 2 diabetes. Okay, so if you develop prediabetes as a result of becoming insulin resistant and your glucose becomes slightly elevated and maybe you are gaining a little bit of weight, then if you don't correct that, that can progress into type 2 diabetes. Once you have type 2 diabetes, you still are insulin resistant de facto. It's just a sort of advanced stage of insulin resistance, and now you have more symptomology that comes along with it, right? Okay, so that's the progression from insulin resistance to prediabetes to type 2 diabetes. Now, gestational diabetes is the type of diabetes that affects women who are pregnant. They usually discover that they are living with gestational diabetes at the 28-week marker, okay, 28 out of 40 weeks into pregnancy, because they get screened for gestational diabetes and some of them end up testing positive. What that means, so most people think of gestational diabetes as being a temporary version of diabetes that only affects you when you are pregnant, okay? Except that is no longer true. That used to be a true statement. And that's what the medical community thought of type of gestational diabetes as. However, what they're discovering now is fascinating, which is that if a mom gets diagnosed with gestational diabetes during pregnancy, it usually indicates, number one, that she likely was significantly insulin resistant going into pregnancy, but she just was unaware. That's number one. Number two, having gestational diabetes during pregnancy increases her risk for complications. And these complications can get pretty nasty, including fatty liver disease and chronic kidney disease and heart disease, okay? So her chronic disease risk is now increased. But here's the thing, her baby's chronic disease risk is increased in utero. So that's why it's so important to really get a handle on gestational diabetes and reverse it as quickly as possible so that you can minimize the impact to the child. But then here's the kicker of this whole thing. If a woman is diagnosed with gestational diabetes, and let's say she presents with at 28 weeks with an elevated blood glucose, and then she delivers her baby at 40 weeks, and then the diabetes kind of magically goes away and her blood glucose returns to normal, that's still not good enough, because if she hasn't corrected her lifestyle and if she hasn't changed the foods that she's eating and her movement patterns, her chances of developing type 2 diabetes at some point in the future is as high as 65%. It's way up there, right? So gestational diabetes, I like to think about it, is it's just a warning sign. That's all it is. It's just a warning sign that, like, number one, you should get your lifestyle under control. Number two, we should get your lifestyle under the control to improve the health of your child. And number three, get your lifestyle under the control so that you don't become a chronic disease patient later in life, okay? And then the final one is Alzheimer's disease or type 3 diabetes. There's a whole body of research that's now growing and getting stronger and stronger and stronger with every passing day and month, which demonstrates that insulin resistance can, it, the primary targets of insulin resistance are your liver and your muscle tissue. Those are the two, what are called peripheral tissues that are outside of your central nervous system. And those two tissues are affected primarily by the development of insulin resistance. Now, it turns out that insulin resistance can also negatively impact your brain. And researchers are now finding this out. And when the body of research suggests that as you develop insulin resistance in your peripheral body, that you also develop insulin resistance inside of your central nervous system. And the effects of that take a long time to develop. And over the course of 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, you can end up developing what's called cognitive decline, which is the reduced ability to, you know, make, to have optimal cognitive power. And that can lead to dementia, which can then lead to Alzheimer's disease. And all of it is related to insulin resistance and high blood glucose earlier in life. So it's a pretty complicated landscape in today's world, but the beauty here is that insulin resistance is the number one connecting puzzle piece between prediabetes, type 2 diabetes, gestational diabetes, and type 3 diabetes. And insulin resistance is the thing that will make your life with type 1 and 1.5 diabetes very complicated. So if you can just get a handle on what insulin resistance is and reverse it using your food as medicine, then your symptomology can practically disappear and all of those non-autoimmune buckets. But in addition to that, it can make your life with type 1 and 1.5 diabetes way easier. Make sense?
Yeah, 100%. That's such a great breakdown across the board. And I think gives us such a great foundation for what we're going to talk about next, because that food as medicine really connects with me. And one of the reasons I was so excited to talk to both of you was down to a gap in my knowledge. When I thought about, and we had this conversation right before we went on air, when I thought about, and again, outside of type 1, type 1.5, like they're the areas that I don't specialize in, but pre-diabetes, type 2, I work with a lot of people as a certified nutritionist with weight change, etc. And even though I refer them to specialists outside of that, I've worked with individuals in that category. And I had the conventional wisdom of low carb, high fat is the best way to treat that. And your book goes through the alternative strategy and potentially a much better way that people could eat when it comes to that food as medicine. Talk to us about that conventional wisdom of low carb, high fat, that diet style, and how it's misguided.
For sure. Okay. So you're absolutely right. You hit this on the head, which is that if you take 100, you know, medical professionals and you put them into a room and you say, what is the best way to treat prediabetes and or type 2 diabetes using food as medicine? 95% of them, 95 out of 100 of them or more will tell you to eat a low carbohydrate diet. Because the research demonstrates that when you eat a low carbohydrate diet, you can stimulate a number of positive effects in the short term. Number one, you can lower your fasting blood glucose, and that's a good thing. Number two, you can lower your post-meal blood glucose, and that's a good thing. Number three, you can lower your A1C value, which is a marker of your average 3-month average blood glucose, and that's a good thing. Number four, you can rapidly lose weight, okay? So if you lose weight, if you lower your A1C, if you lower your fasting blood glucose, and if you lower your post-meal blood glucose, then you're doing a great job at handling diabetes, and you're doing a good job at reversing the process that created the high blood glucose in the first place, right? So a lot of the research shows this exact same story over and over and over and over and over again, okay? But here's the problem with a low carbohydrate diet. A low carbohydrate diet can certainly serve as a very effective tool in the short term to accomplish all of what we just talked about, plus also reduce your blood pressure, which happens for many individuals, and get you to a much healthier state, so that on a piece of paper, when your doctor takes a look at your biomarkers, they go, oh my gosh, look at all this. You know, there's a significant reduction in these biomarkers, and even your C-reactive protein has gone down. There's less inflammation inside of your body. Things are moving in the right direction. Congratulations. The problem, though, is if you look into the research and try and figure out what happens over the course of time, what you're likely to find is that in the first 6 months to 12 months of eating a low carbohydrate diet, all these positive benefits come around. But if you fast forward and you move 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years into the future, the picture changes, and it changes in a very negative way. And what ends up happening is that individuals who eat a low carbohydrate diet with all these positive benefits in the short term end up with negative effects in the long term. And those negative effects include, number one, a plateau in their weight loss journey, which can then sometimes lead to weight gain over the course of time. So even though they lost the weight in the short term within the 6 to 12 month period, oftentimes the research demonstrates that the weight starts to come back, and all of a sudden they're either back at their original weight or they're maybe like slightly under their original weight, but the weight loss is no longer significant. That's number one. Number two, LDL cholesterol. We have to talk about LDL cholesterol in a low carbohydrate diet because LDL cholesterol is considered the most atherogenic particle type, meaning it's the type of particle that's considered your quote unquote bad cholesterol. And this cholesterol is the one that has been shown to be not just associated with, but causational in a future cardiac event. In other words, if your LDL concentration is high, that predisposes you to a very high risk for heart disease at some point in the future. Okay, when you eat a low carbohydrate diet, you can get a reduction in many biomarkers, but your LDL concentration goes up. And people have seen this over and over and over again. There's plenty of research papers that demonstrate that no matter how much your blood pressure falls, no matter how much your triglyceride falls, no matter how much improvement you get in body weight, your LDL cholesterol goes up. And that's really important because that predisposes you, again, to a risk for a future cardiac event, and nobody wants that. Okay? And then as far as insulin resistance is concerned, this is where most people are, they make erroneous conclusions, okay? Again, if you do something that lowers your fasting blood glucose and your post-meal blood glucose and your A1C value, you might think, you might come to the conclusion that because you're getting a lower blood glucose most of the day, that means that de facto you are now more insulin sensitive. It's a logical conclusion, right? But the problem is that there's only really one way to directly measure insulin resistance. And the one way to directly measure insulin resistance is to provide someone with what's called a glucose challenge, okay? And the test that you can do in a laboratory setting is called a euglycemic hyperinsulinemic clamp. It is way complicated. We're not going to get into detail here exactly about how to perform that test. But suffice it to say that that is a test that has to be done under medical supervision. It requires an IV drip of glucose. It requires an IV administration of insulin, and it requires 4 hours of your time. It's very complicated. It costs a lot of money. There's an alternative test that you can go to Quest Diagnostics and get, or you can go to LabCorp or any, you know, testing facility. It's called a glucose tolerance test, a GTT, or sometimes people refer to it as an OGTT, an oral glucose tolerance test. What ends up happening is they give you a solution, which is literally 75 grams of glucose dissolved in water. You drink that solution, and over the course of the next 2 hours, if they administer the test properly, they're gonna measure your blood glucose every half an hour for 2 hours, and they're gonna measure your insulin every half an hour for 2 hours. So they measure it at baseline, and then at 30 minutes, and then at 60 minutes, and then at 90 minutes, and then at 120 minutes. And they construct two different graphs. Graph number one is, what did your blood glucose do over a 2 hour period? How high did it go, and how quickly did it come back down, okay? In other words, what's the area under the curve of that glucose excursion? That's graph number one. Graph number two is, what did your insulin level do? How high did it go, and how quickly did it come back to normal? In other words, what is the area under the insulin curve? And you can take those two pieces of information together, and you can combine the area under the curve for glucose and the area under the curve for insulin, and that right there will tell you whether you're insulin sensitive or insulin resistant or somewhere in the middle. Okay, so that is the only test that you can take as an individual that will directly measure your level of insulin resistance. But here's the thing, if you look into the research and you try and figure out, well, what did these research papers do? What were the tests that they performed in order to determine whether or not somebody was insulin resistant or insulin sensitive? They don't use that test. They don't use that test. What they do is they do a mathematical calculation by looking at only someone's fasting blood glucose and only someone's fasting insulin, and they plug it into this calculation called HOMAIR, H-O-M-A-I-R, and they come up with a number and they go, oh, look, the HOMAIR got better. Therefore, this person is now more insulin sensitive. But the HOMAIR has a function, it has a purpose, and it basically measures what happens in the basal or in the fasting state only. It does not measure what happens when you give somebody a glucose challenge. And as a result of that, you're only measuring a small piece of the insulin resistance spectrum. So if you really want to measure insulin resistance directly, you have to administer an OGTT. And when you do administer an OGTT on people who eat a low carbohydrate diet, it doesn't look good. It doesn't look good at all. Blood glucose goes quite high, 160, 180, 200 in metric units. That's upwards of a 10 millimoles, right, or higher. And then insulin levels also tend to go pretty darn high within that 2-hour window. And a high area under the curve of glucose and a high area under the curve of insulin leads to a very highly insulin resistant state. Okay? The very last thing I'll say here on this topic is that if you don't perform an oral glucose tolerance test, you don't really understand what's happening. But secondarily, the low carbohydrate community likes to kick back against everything that I just said. And they say, Cyrus, no, you don't understand. You don't understand. Under normal circumstances, if I'm not eating anything carbohydrate rich because I'm eating a low carbohydrate diet, or if I'm not eating anything that contains refined glucose, then why the heck would I go to a laboratory and go drink 75 grams of glucose to test whether or not my blood glucose and insulin levels are going to go high? It's not physiologically relevant. Okay. And my answer to that is great. If you're not drinking refined glucose from a bottle on a daily basis, my hat's off to you. I'm going to give you a high five. Neither am I. Nobody should be technically doing that, right? But the test is designed to give you a standardized amount of glucose so that you can compare between individuals and find out whether Brian's insulin sensitivity was different than Cyrus's, was different than Robbie's, was different than Michelle's, and so on and so forth. So you have to come up with a standardized method of doing that. And the oral glucose tolerance test is that standardized test. And when you perform it on people who are eating a low carbohydrate diet or ketogenic diet versus people who are eating a low fat diet, the results are night and day different.
Brian, I just want to add to this, like this is the crux of the issue amongst, you know, the highly intelligent group of people who is citing research and saying, oh, look at this research. It just, this is a high quality paper and a high quality journal. And it shows that, you know, this diet outperformed that diet, or this low carb diet made somebody more insulin sensitive. And the HOMAIR topic that Cyrus just brought up, that is huge. And what's happening is, like Cyrus said, it's two numbers going to that calculation. You're fasting insulin and you're fasting blood glucose. Of course, when you stop eating carbohydrates, you start eating a low carbohydrate diet, of course, your fasting insulin comes down. Absolutely. You're not consistently challenging yourself with carbohydrates. And we see this in the type 1 diabetes world as well. And that's where, you know, Cyrus and I have this insight that a lot of other people don't have. Because we're living with type 1 diabetes, we monitor our blood glucose, we calculate the carbohydrates we're consuming so we know how much insulin to inject, and we know exactly how much insulin we're injecting. Whereas somebody like you and most of your listeners, they can get the carb count, they can test their blood glucose, but they don't know how much insulin is being produced. So when you look at research comparing, you know, type 1s following a low carbohydrate diet, their 24-hour carbohydrate to insulin ratio is about 1:1. So for every 1 gram of carbohydrate they consume, they need to inject 1 unit of insulin. Whereas for Cyrus and myself, our 24-hour ratio is more like 26:1, 27:1. So it's a dramatic difference. And insulin sensitivity is really something that we have to pay attention to here for not just blood glucose control, but long-term health risk.
How would you recommend reversing insulin resistance then? And I'm curious, is the recommendation similar to people in your position with type 1 or someone with type 1.5, pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes. Is the recommendation the same or does it vary across the board? And if it's the same, what's the general recommendation? I'm very curious as somebody that has gaps. This isn't my area. This isn't my specialty. Hence the curiosity in the question. But talk to us about how you'd recommend reversing that insulin resistance then, and if it's the same across the board or differs from the type of diabetes that you have.
Okay, this is a great question. I'm going to start with the fundamentals here and then throw it back to Cyrus to talk about some of the biochemistry. All right. So the answer to your question is it's the same approach no matter what type of diabetes you're living with. And that's what we do at Mastering Diabetes. You see it in the book. We're unifying everybody who's living with any form of diabetes to focus on one thing. What lifestyle choices can you make to allow insulin to work more efficiently? Whether you're injecting insulin or whether you're trying to get the insulin you're producing endogenously to work more efficiently, we're going to apply the same principles. And that principle is a low-fat, plant-based whole food diet, which is low in trans fat, low in saturated fat, also low in advanced glycation end products, low in heme iron, low in excess sodium, and you put this all together, and that's how you help basically reverse insulin resistance. But again, I'll throw it back to Cyrus for the primary cause of insulin resistance being excess dietary fat.
Yeah, so let me tell you a quick story here. Back in 2007, when I first started my graduate degree at UC Berkeley, I had the opportunity of working with one of the world's experts in carbohydrate metabolism. His name is Dr. Mark Hellerstein. And this guy is literally, you've seen the movie Good Will Hunting before? Mm.
Yeah.
So you know how Matt Damon plays the role of this like boy genius who just like he can do any mathematical computation in his head very easily. Mark Hellerstein is a true Good Will Hunting. This guy is so smart that when he's saying something, I'm literally following him around with a pen and paper, writing down everything that he possibly said so that I can go study it after the fact and like actually learn it, right? So he gave me the opportunity to study everything that there is to learn about insulin resistance. And we did a whole collection of experiments in laboratory animals and mice and rats to try and understand how do you, number one, how do you create insulin resistance? Number two, how can you turn insulin resistance into a non-reversible state? Meaning if you move into the type 2 diabetes realm, is that even reversible? Yes or no? And then we started implementing a whole bunch of techniques to try and reverse the insulin resistance phenotype to get it back to being quote unquote normal metabolism. So as you can imagine, there were hundreds of experiments that we ran over the course of time to try and figure out what creates insulin resistance and what reverses it and what's the most effective technique. And so when I started studying this branch of physiology, I went into the medical research to try and figure out how have other researchers created insulin resistance both in mice and in rats and in human beings. And what I was expecting to see was that the research would tell me that you should, in order to create insulin resistance, you should feed people carbs, right? You should feed mice carbs. You should feed rats carbs. And truth be told, I hate the word carbs, so I'm going to use carbohydrate because it's more accurate, okay? So you should use a high carbohydrate approach because what the methodology is, what the low carbohydrate world has told us, is that if you eat carbohydrate anything, that will lead to a spike in insulin production, which will then lead to an insulin resistance phenotype. So I kind of went with that. And then I was like, okay, well, maybe in addition to just plain carbohydrate, what if you were to consume refined carbohydrates like table sugar or high fructose corn syrup or refined fructose? Maybe that would accelerate the development of insulin resistance and we could, you know, get a more reliable and repeatable method. Well, it turns out when I went into the scientific literature to look and try and figure out how is insulin resistance created in, again, mice, rats, and human beings, the answer was totally different. Totally different. The answer was lipids, triglyceride, saturated fat. Everywhere I looked, it said, if you want to induce insulin resistance, you feed animals a high fat diet, a high saturated fat diet, upwards of 70% of total calories coming from fat and coming from fat that contains a significant amount of saturated fat, okay? Coming from fat sources with a significant amount of saturated fat, which is primarily animal-based fats, okay? And in human papers, you see the exact same thing. In order to induce insulin resistance, you feed a diet that is high in fat, containing a significant amount of saturated fat. And when you do that, that creates the insulin resistance phenotype. And I was like, You have got to be kidding me. This is fascinating because the whole world wants you to believe that it's all about carbs and sugar, but yet the research world is telling a completely different story. And that right there was where I was like, wait a minute, what the heck is going on here? Something seems very off, right? So over the course of the next 5 years, again, we did so many experiments to try and create insulin resistance. And when you feed animals a high fat diet, 8 weeks, they're insulin resistant, their glucose is through the roof, their insulin production is very high, and then you can start to reverse that phenotype using a whole collection of different methodologies, right? So what I have come to learn over the course of the last, it's been 15 years now, actually it's been 20 years since I first changed my diet and beyond, is that if you do a deep dive into the biochemistry of insulin resistance, what you'll find is that when you eat fat-rich foods from the outside world, what you are actually eating is foods that contain what are called triglyceride molecules, okay? So triglycerides are basically a glycerol backbone with three fatty acids attached to that glycerol backbone. So triglyceride means three fatty acids attached to glycerol, okay? So you consume a food that contains a lot of triglyceride. Now, that could be something like chicken or salmon or olive oil or eggs or bacon or dairy products or cheese. It could also contain stuff from the plant-based world like nuts and seeds and avocados and even coconut meat, coconut oil, olives, things like that, okay? You consume those foods. They contain a lot of triglycerides. The triglycerides end up going in your mouth. You chew them up. They travel down your esophagus. They get inside of your stomach. Your stomach, basically, the walls of your stomach secrete hydrochloric acid to try and start to denature proteins and sort of get access to this material and just start to linearize it a little bit to pre-prepare it for entrance into the next compartment, which is your small intestine. Once that stuff gets into your small intestine, it's called chyme, which is basically partially digested food material. That partially digested food material is then acted upon by a whole bunch of digestive enzymes that are manufactured by your small intestine, by your liver and your pancreas. So these digestive enzymes have one particular goal in mind, and that is to take things that are large and break them down into things that are small. Okay, so they want to start to tear apart the triglyceride molecule to start to break down protein into amino acids and carbohydrate into individual monosaccharides and beyond. So these digestive enzymes have a whole bunch of different names. They're lipases, they're proteases, they're carbohydrases. They're there to act upon the food and try and break it down. So the triglycerides are separated. The three fatty acids are separated from the glycerol. And as a result of that, you end up with fatty acids inside of your small intestine that then get absorbed through the walls of your small intestine to get put into these things called chylomicron particles. These chylomicron particles are like these little spaceships, and there's trillions of them in circulation. The chylomicron particles are literally nothing but like a catcher's mitt to receive the fatty acid molecule and then transport that fatty acid molecule elsewhere. So these chylomicron particles receive a whole bunch of fatty acids from the food that you consumed, and then they circulate over the course of the next couple of hours to deliver those fatty acids to some other tissue. So in an ideal world, those chylomicrons would deliver those fatty acids only to your adipose tissue because that's the right place to put them. It's a safe place to put them. It's a tissue that's specifically designed to absorb fatty acids when present and to hold on to them for a long period of time. From an enzymatic perspective, from a mechanical perspective, it's the perfect place to put them. But what ends up happening is that a majority of those fatty acids go to your adipose tissue, which is great, but then there's a spillover. And some of those fatty acids end up inside of your liver, and some of those fatty acids end up inside of your muscle. Now that would be all good and there would be no problem, except for the fact that your liver and muscle have a very small capacity to be able to store triglyceride and to be able to uptake fatty acids from the chylomicron particles, right? So if you're eating a low fat diet, then the amount of fatty acids that come in through your diet would be small, and then therefore they wouldn't overwhelm your liver and they wouldn't overwhelm your muscle. But when you're eating a low carbohydrate / high fat diet, what ends up happening is that the amount of fatty acids that get inside of your liver and muscle after every single meal is high. And in a short period of time, and I'm talking something like on the order of 24 to 48 hours, you can induce a net accumulation of fatty acids inside of your liver and muscle. And as a result of that, those two tissues now have a problem. Okay. The problem is that they're absorbing more fatty acids than they were designed to absorb in the first place. And as a result of that, now they have accumulated excess fatty acids. And so they're like, ah, crap, what the heck are we going to do at this point? Right? Now we got this problem. We didn't ask for this fatty acid material. You just went and ate a whole bunch of stuff. And now I'm the one that has to deal with it. Thank you so much. Right? So in that situation, the liver and muscle tissue have to create some kind of self-defense mechanism to prevent themselves from taking on more and more and more and more energy, because they do not want any more energy in this situation. Okay? They've absorbed too much energy and they're trying to like shut their doors to energy. So the easiest way to shut doors to energy is to block insulin from working. And the reason for that is because insulin is the most powerful anabolic hormone in your body. It's the most powerful hormone that can stimulate cell growth and fuel storage. There's no other hormone in your body. I don't care what it is, whether it's human growth hormone, whether it's IGF-1, nothing is more powerful than insulin at getting fuel into tissues and promoting cells to grow and divide. So cells know that. And so what they do is they say, okay, hold on a second, check this out. We got a whole bunch of fatty acid material. We didn't ask for it. It's too much. We've overaccumulated it. If we want to block more of this fatty acid material from coming in, why don't we just stop talking to insulin? Because insulin is present and insulin is in the bloodstream at all times. And if we can effectively tell insulin that we don't want to communicate with it anymore, then we can slow down the rate at which these fatty acids get inside. We can also slow down the rate of amino acids and the rate of glucose entrance as well. So that's what they do, is they initiate this thing called insulin resistance, which is literally insulin rejection. And what they do is they basically take the insulin receptors that are on the outside of the cell membrane and they're like, hey, insulin receptors, get inside. And the fatty acid molecules, actually they go and they cripple the internal domain of these insulin receptors, and they make the insulin receptors less effective. And so what that means is that in that state, when these tissues have developed, they've crippled the ability of their insulin receptors to behave normally. The next time you eat something that's carbohydrate rich, it could be literally one banana. It could be a peach. It could be a handful of raisins or maybe a bowl of quinoa, like anything that contains carbohydrate, even if it comes from whole carbohydrate like we are recommending. What happens is that the carbohydrate gets broken down into glucose. The glucose then tries to get inside of the tissue, tries to get inside of your liver and muscle where it belongs. But the glucose can't get inside by itself. The insulin has to knock on the door and say, hey, knock, knock, there's glucose in the blood. Do you want to take it up? And both of those tissues respond by saying, I'm not paying attention to you right now, insulin. I have a whole bunch of fatty acid material inside of me right now. I am playing insulin resistance, so you can go and stay in the bloodstream and don't talk to me until you can get rid of this fatty acid material. So that then means that insulin gets rejected. Insulin effectively accumulates in your blood, causing what's called hyperinsulinemia, meaning excess insulin in your blood. Big problem. Number two, the glucose can't get inside of those tissues because the insulin couldn't tell the tissue to open its doors. So as a result of that, insulin gets trapped and glucose gets trapped. And as a result of that, you become hyperinsulinemic and hyperglycemic at the same time. Elevated glucose, elevated insulin simultaneously. That is insulin resistance in a nutshell.
That's a brilliant breakdown. I had a little bit of baseline knowledge on that when it comes to fatty acids or dietary fat with carbohydrates, and how the analogy that I've heard people use is it's like the setting up the perfect storm for bad things to happen in terms of your body's physiological response. But I never actually understood it until you put it that way and used that example. So that really helped me. So a massive thank you personally. I'm very curious, because in the book towards the end, and I'll put the link in the description for everybody that's listening so they can pick up a copy. Highly recommend it if this is something you're struggling with. As you both have said, you've had it for large portions of your life, and now you're spending time educating people and showing them this alternative way that can potentially help them. So I'm so grateful, and I know everybody listening is in that same boat will be exactly the same. But towards the end of your book, you've got meal plans and recipes and things that people can eat. But I'm very curious, when it comes to food principles, we talked about plant-based, etc. there, what would be some of the food principles for somebody that's listening to this who's on any side of the spectrum from type 1 all the way up to potentially type 2, I think gestational, a little bit different in terms of what you said. But, and again, I don't want to go into an area that I'm unfamiliar with because I wouldn't even know what the next question should be. But to keep it in the realm of where I'm able to understand as well, what would you say in terms of food principles? Should it be primarily plant-based and then building on top of that? Or what would you have as kind of a pyramid of prioritization when it comes to food principles following a plan like this?
Brian, this is one of my favorite topics in the entire world to talk about, okay? So at Mastering Diabetes, we have taken some food principles and put them into a very simple system to follow. There's green light foods, yellow light foods, and red light foods. The green light foods, foods that we suggest you consume ad libitum. It's almost impossible to eat too much of these foods. And the first food category is fruits. That's all fruits, bananas, papayas, mangoes, pears, peaches, you name it, whole fruits. The second category would then be starchy vegetables. That's like potatoes, yam, squash would fit in that category. Then beans, peas, and lentils. All right, that's self-explanatory. Then intact whole grains, intact being the key word. So we're talking brown rice, quinoa, millet, farro. So those are the first four categories in the green light category. And every single one of those four provides significant caloric content, all right? Because a lot of people, they'll transition to a plant-based diet and they'll be afraid of consuming too many carbs. Like, oh, wow, you know, I'll just start eating a lot of lettuce. I'll start eating a lot of salads. And then they're not satisfied and they don't stick with the program any longer because they're afraid of the carbohydrate-rich foods. Whereas we're teaching people, as you go through the transition, you're simultaneously decreasing fat intake, just for the reasons Cyrus just explained, and increasing whole carbohydrate foods, which includes water, fiber, vitamins, minerals, okay? So those first four categories are in a specific order. Plus, we're suggesting that especially during the transition, every meal is gonna include either leafy greens, non-starchy vegetables, herbs and spices, or mushrooms. That's the rest of the green light category. And again, we help people who are in a chronic disease state. All right. People come to us, they already have prediabetes. They already have type 2 diabetes. They're already living with some form of insulin resistance that's causing them problems. That's why they come to our coaching program. So we are very much focused on optimization of getting out of a chronic disease state. Some people might be listening to this, oh, maybe I don't want to take it as far. Maybe they don't want to be as disciplined, and that's up to them. But like, this is how you heal people with a chronic disease, particularly insulin resistance. So in the beginning, having those greens, those non-starchy vegetables at every meal is going to help blunt blood glucose spikes you might be expecting because you're eating more carbohydrate-rich foods. And of course, you're decreasing the fat intake, all right? So that's the green light category. Eat as much of those foods as you want. The yellow light category, these are foods that are very healthy, proven by plenty of evidence-based research. They're great. You should consume them. You just have to be cognizant of how much you're consuming. So avocado, nuts and seeds, olives, whole soy products. Okay, so soy products are a little bit high in fat. The best form you can have is edamame. That's the most whole intact form of soy. Then you can go to tempeh, then you can go to tofu. Those are good options, but anything soy related is about 40% of calories coming from fat, even again, edamame, the whole form of eating soy. All right, so those are plant-based foods, nutrient dense, plenty of great research supporting them. You just can't have too much. You can't just sit down and watch a movie and just start snacking on nuts and seeds if you want to reverse insulin resistance. You could sit down and start snacking on some bell peppers and some mangoes and some peaches. That's going to be great. Different story. All right. The other foods in the yellow light category we want people to be, again, cognizant of how much you're consuming is going to be, so bread. So something like Ezekiel bread, it's a great option. Even if you're going to have something like a millet bread, that's great. It's a little bit more calorie dense. It's better to have millet than millet bread. We really want to steer towards those green light, unrefined whole foods as much as possible. Then the other foods we'd put in this category would be fermented foods. Again, a bunch of research showing support of eating those, but they're high in sodium. And when you're trying to reverse insulin resistance, you got to be cognizant of that. You just don't go to town and eat a crap ton of fermented food, all right? The red light category, these are foods we're suggesting people minimize or completely avoid. And this is going to include all animal products. So we're talking fish, chicken, red meat, dairy products. We want to limit or avoid those. We also put oil in this category. And the reason oil's in this category is because it's pure fat. It's 100% fat, which is very problematic when you're trying to reverse insulin resistance. It is, a water's been removed. This thing is a, no, it's banging. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I was like, I wonder, is that on Cyrus' side or Robbie's side? If they came out of the red foods or the red flag foods, you'd have to bang it. It would work in nicely. So for people listening, that's just background noise. Ignore it. It has nothing to do with what we're talking about.
It's too funny. Okay. So I want to talk about oil real quick. So people get really upset with us when we say no oil. Okay. And I want to just make it clear. I'm sorry for the banging, guys. they know this is a hot topic. Here's the thing. I was just reading a paper a couple days ago of the top 100 richest dietary sources of polyphenols, okay? And on this list, it does include olive oil. But what's even further above that is just having some whole olives. If you have whole olives, you're going to get more polyphenols, more antioxidants, and for the same weight, 75% less calories. And as a society, we don't need more calories, all right? We need to lose weight. We need more whole foods, more water, more fiber. We need more bulk so we don't eat too much. So whatever oils you're enjoying, our recommendation is just eat some of those whole foods. If it's avocado oil, have some more avocados. If it's sesame oil, have some sesame seeds, all right? That's where you should get that nutrition from, whole foods. Now, in the red light category, we also have some of the obvious stuff. You know, don't eat packaged and processed foods. Don't eat Twinkies. And some of the even more modern day foods, there's a lot of, you know, plant-based burgers out there, these meat alternatives. We put all that in the red light category. We're not suggesting people eat packaged junk food. Again, we're going towards whole foods, which is what is mostly the green light, yellow light category, focusing on, again, low fat plant-based whole food coming from green light. And that's our simple system. And it truly is that simple, Brian. Like if people just stuck with that color system, like they're good to go. They don't need to overcomplicate this.
I love that. And it sticks with, as you mentioned, that food is medicine. Like it's not necessarily that, this is one of my biggest pet peeves as a nutritionist. Now I'm in a kind of a body composition performance, is when people that are vegan are like, oh yeah, healthy diet. I'm like, plant-based vegan diet is a very healthy diet. If you're eating a lot of processed rubbish and burgers with a million ingredients that have been made up on plant-based, I'm like, not necessarily going to be healthy in terms of nutrient density in that food. So I'm delighted that you clarified the difference for that for people. And I think there's just so much value in today's episode. And I know the book, which as I mentioned, I will link in the description for people. It goes through everything from the approach that you take. It expands beyond some of the ideas we talked about here with what causes insulin resistance, how to increase your insulin sensitivity, all the way down to the meal plans and things we didn't even touch on in today's episode, from intermittent fasting and exercising for maximum insulin sensitivity, all these things that when you put them together can potentially be a perfect recipe for reversing that insulin resistance and becoming more insulin sensitive. And just with that chronic issue, whether it's type 1 all the way to type 2 and everything in between, it's going to improve and potentially improve your quality of life, which ultimately I can tell from talking to both of you, that's your goal with people. And I love that you're doing it. And I'm so glad we got to have this conversation. I will link up the book, as I mentioned. I know the website is masteringdiabetes.org. I'll also link that in the description. But is there anywhere else you'd like to send people, social media, any other websites, anything else that you want to send people to? Please do that now, lads.
For sure. So because your audience is primarily outside of the United States, in Ireland, and I think the UK, if I'm not mistaken, for those of you who are interested in picking up a copy of the Mastering Diabetes book. So it was released in 2020, in just before the pandemic hit. And we actually, in the first week of releasing the book, became a New York Times bestseller, which we were very excited about. And I'm not saying that like to brag or anything. It's more what we like about the fact is that this message is getting out and it's really infiltrating society and it's starting to change the way people are thinking about the food that they put into their body. Because for so long, it's been about eating a low carb this, low carb that, low carb this, low carb that. And there is a time and place for a low carbohydrate diet. But unfortunately, in the long term, it is not a good solution. And we just want to educate people about that so that you can put yourself in the most advantageous position now and into the future. So long story short, if you're international, you can pick up the book at Book Depository. And that's probably the easiest place to get it. So all you have to do is just go to masteringdiabetes.org/book. masteringdiabetes.org/book. If you go there, you can read about the book. You can take a look at it. You can watch a video. And then you can, there's a link for Book Depository there, or Amazon or Barnes and Noble or IndieBound. You can click on those links and it can take you to whatever website works best for you to go pick up a copy. You can also get the book in Kindle format as well. And you know, you can also get the audiobook as well, if that's helpful for you. So however you enjoy consuming content, grab it, pay attention to it. And Brian, thank you so much for letting us come here and talk your ear off about diabetes. It's such an important topic, and you're doing such a phenomenal job of teaching people the true tenets of how to live a long term, how to live a life in the long term with a low disease risk. And I appreciate that significantly. So thank you for all your time and for your effort.
Oh, my pleasure. And I'm so glad we got to have this conversation. As I said, I was really excited before the episode to learn a little bit more about it, because there was gaps in my knowledge. And I know there's so many people out there who are all the way from the minor inconvenience to full on suffering bracket. And if we can fill in those educational gaps to improve people's quality of life, I'm all for that. So I'm so glad that we got to have this chat. So Robbie, Cyrus, thank you so much again.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, my man.
There you have it, Cyrus Cambata, PhD, and Robbie Barbero on Mastering Diabetes, the Revolutionary Method to Reverse Insulin Resistance Permanently in Type 1, Type 2, and Pre-Diabetes. This is a podcast I learned absolutely loads from. I had gaps in my knowledge around this, and some of the things Cyrus said in particular when it comes to the scientific evidence and what's actually happening physiologically in our body really connected with me and thankfully filled in those gaps. So I'm so glad I got to have this conversation. This is a podcast that, if it served you, or you know family members or friends who fall on this diabetic spectrum, for example, my partner's, my girlfriend's brother is type 1 diabetic and my father's pre-diabetic. So both of those people I will be passing this episode on to. And if you have friends or family members who fall into that category, please do so as well. That's everything from me from this week's episode. Catch you all next Monday.